This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service and international development. This series is brought to you by Olam, a joint platform for promoting global Jewish service, and the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Shani Rosenbaum. In our second season, we bring you Global Torah Live, conversations about the intersections between Jewish text, Jewish life, and global citizenship, recorded before live audiences around the world. Today's episode explores a new angle on one of our favorite topics, Jews, philanthropy, and global responsibility. There's very little most Jews agree upon, but it's probably safe to say that tzedakah, charitable giving, is widely accepted to be a core Jewish value. But when we start asking questions about how we choose to give, to whom, how much, that's when the conversation starts to get a little stickier. So how do we as Jews prioritize our giving? How much of our giving should focus within our own community? How much should we be extending our generosity to other communities in need? Joining me to crack open these questions are two experts in the fields of Jewish and global giving. Ruth Messenger, Global Ambassador for the Human Rights and Development Organization, American Jewish World Service, and Shoshana Boyd-Gelfand, a seasoned philanthropy professional and current director of J-Hub in London. You're listening to our live conversation at the 2016 Limud UK Conference in Birmingham. So I wanted to start by hearing from both of you some of your early memories of the value of tzedakah. Was that a value in your families, in your Jewish communities growing up? And was global on the table in your early lives?
That's such a great question. No, is the simple answer, but I'll tell you a story which is all the more remarkable because the answer was no. When I was a very young child, we moved to Florida when I was 6 years old. We moved right into the Baptist Bible Belt because Jewish wasn't really on the radar screen for my family. And we were the only Jewish family in the county, really. There was a little one-room synagogue that we found. And the memory that I have, so I was 7 years old, and the Yom Kippur War broke out. And both my parents are physicians. And I remember it because it was my first awareness that there was a world outside of, you know, my family, my school, my town. And that was a fight that my parents were having. And the fight went something like this. My father saying, "I'm going." And my mother saying, "You can't go. You have four small children." And my father saying, "But I'm a doctor, and they need doctors, and I need to go." And I remember that. And I remember the energy behind that. And then my father didn't go, but it started me asking questions of, where is this place that you want to go? And we ended up at this little one-room synagogue. I'd never been in a synagogue in my life. That's how off the radar it was with my family. But I brought my piggy bank. So something in my family very much sent the message that there is something happening out there that you have a responsibility to do something about. And I didn't know what it was, but if it was important enough for my daddy to go over there and to be a doctor over there, well, by golly, it was important enough to have my piggy bank. So I think that's my earliest memory where, on the one hand, no, it wasn't part of my family, but hell yeah, it was. You know, it very much was that it filtered through that way.
And something I hear in that is at that moment, somehow you'd absorbed that there was a value. If you can't physically be in a place to contribute, then there's another way you can contribute, and that funds are sort of a default for sort of a stand-in for that.
Yeah, and I think what's striking for me, because I really didn't have any Jewish identity at the time, I'd never been in a synagogue. That was really my first time in a synagogue, was the notion that my Jewish identity, and that was the very beginning of my Jewish identity, was somehow tied up in people over there who I didn't even know existed. So I think there's also the beginning of that notion, which is at the heart of what we're talking about today.
So for me, the answer is mixed, yes and no, based on your original question. But I just would point out to the audience, we are 20 years different in age. So it's a very different time that we were each being exposed to this. So for me, I was a child in the 1940s. And so, first of all, I was brought up in a household that was decidedly and clearly Jewish and tremendously committed to giving. Slightly disparaging. My mother was always disparaging of almost anything she could find to disparage, but in a good way. She was wonderful. But slightly disparaging of only giving money and partly because we didn't have as much money as some other families that my parents knew, although we were very comfortable and very passionate about giving time. So in my family, I have the most immense number of years between my mother's two parents, my maternal grandparents, and my mother and father gave, I would promise you, tens of thousands of hours to the boards of Jewish organizations that were federation organizations throughout my lifetime. So a lot about giving and the responsibility of giving. Also discovered many, 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 many years later that my dad, Olav Sholem, when he died, I started getting their mail. I discovered that my father had given to every charity that ever wrote him. I mean, you have no idea. In New York City, you can easily be besieged by 200 charities, and they were, I'm sure he didn't give any of them more than $18, but the mail kept coming and coming and coming, like, where is this man? Anyway, but on the global issue, so this is actually true, but long before I knew, there was a little bit about the earliest days, because it was the earliest days of statehood and Israel and trees in Israel. But my first exposure to global, I am a very, as some people here know me well, I'm a stubborn person. And like many of you, you all have different countries about which this was true. But when I wouldn't eat what was on my plate, my mother said, think of the poor starving Armenians. And I said, send it to the Armenians. I don't want it.
Great, thanks. So if I move each of you sort of forward in your own trajectories, thinking about how you developed your sense of where you prioritize giving or sort of where the value of giving money sits in your own lives, how did that develop for each of you over time? And what or whom influenced you in that journey?
So the simple answer to that is I learned that by being around generous people. And the earliest one was my Southern black nanny. And if you've ever read the book, The Help, that is the world that I grew up in. And it was in the Deep South right after desegregation, although not really. Everything was still very, it wasn't segregated by law, but everybody knew where to go and what to do and which bus and where to sit on, that sort of thing. And she was such a part of my family's life. And she was part of a Southern Black Baptist church where everybody gave 10% of their income, which was nothing, but they gave 10% of nothing to the church. And the church did everything. When there was a wedding, the church threw the wedding. And when there was a funeral, the church did the funeral. And when somebody needed clothes for their baby, the church did that. And I, because I was very little, went in and out of her church quite a lot. And so that sense of community really captured my imagination. That sense that there is a higher purpose that calls this for you, that demands this of you, spoke to me. And somehow the Jesus bit just got filtered out completely. And I absorbed all of these values, which were such Jewish values, from this woman who lived her life, I literally as if Jesus was sitting next to her every second of her day. And it was a very, very easy transition for me to when I recognized that once I became involved in Jewish life and started working in the world of foundations with some extraordinary philanthropists, namely Leslie Wexner and Trevor Pears are the two I've worked most closely with, but so many others who live exactly what she taught me, which is somehow this abundance which I have and I've worked for and I've earned is not mine. And being around people who have that kind of mindset that somehow it doesn't belong to me and therefore I'm not giving it, I am simply passing it along to the people who it should be with. I think that was part of what really gave me this sense of it's not about being a giver, it's just about allowing abundance to flow through one if one is privileged enough to be in the presence of abundance.
Well, first of all, I think not surprisingly to either of us, we share precisely that sense. I also want to say, in case Shoshana doesn't say it soon enough, Shoshana works for and has worked for among the most, not just generous, but thoughtful philanthropists in terms of giving in broader and broader circles of obligation and recognizing need all over the world and recognizing different kinds of need in the American Jewish community and in the American urban community. And if God has her way, more and more philanthropists will develop that attitude because it's not common. In terms of your question, so I already answered part of it. So constant talk about giving, of giving time, about all the work that all of these different agencies did. I was like at our breakfast table talking about, you know, meetings, board meetings, policy decisions. So all of that was there. And I would add to that that relatively early in my life, again, because of my mother made it really clear, and I'm going to say this very clearly because at least I'm talking to the Americans in the room, this is not yet clear to a lot of people in America. My mother made it clear to me that the broad panoply of Jewish organizations in New York, funded by the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, supported the needs of Jews and non-Jews. That they were highly ecumenical and broad in their giving and in their understanding of who was in the greatest need and of admitting, you know, if they were going to do Meals on Wheels, if they're going to do a senior center, if they're going to do child care. Some of these were the issues of court cases, which my mother actually had a big role in. But so I knew right from the very beginning that it was not only this issue of giving time and money, but giving it broadly and giving it to those who most needed it. I want to make one comment, not about your nanny specifically, but about giving in black churches. So Shoshana saw it in one church in Florida. For some of those of you who don't know, I was in public life in New York for 20 years. I think it is fair to say, been in many more black churches with my husband who's sitting here than most of you. And I want to say that the tithing behavior is extraordinary, and we have so much to learn. So in churches in New York, first of all, there are three collections during an hour and a half service. But the tithing collection is they announce it's the tithing collection, and people, and these people probably making not lots of money, but probably more than your nanny. So these are mostly people who are New York City and New York State civil servants. If the tithing collection, they get up once every 2 weeks when their paycheck has come, and they go up to the front of the room and deposit the equivalent of 10% of the check they just got in the box. And the entire choir sings the whole time, and it's like a moment of real faith-based glory, and it's fine with me if Jesus is right in the middle of it, because you're seeing all these people seriously taking this notion that 10% of what they get belongs to the church to do its good works. It's very impressive.
So it's striking to me that both of you focused on this, the tithing practice within churches, and what it makes me think of a little bit is the question of the structure of how giving is done in the Jewish community. And my understanding is that federation-based giving was more popular, at least in the U.S., and it's sort of on its way out, that it used to be the Jewish community sort of entrusted their funds to a federation that would then distribute it. And more large and small philanthropists are sort of looking to cater their giving to very specific institutions of their choosing. So I'm wondering if each of you could speak to, both in the UK and the American communities, where our structures have come from and where they're going in terms of how we're choosing to direct our funds and whether you think we're going in the right direction.
So I've been in the UK now for 10 years, but I still sort of keep my finger on the pulse of my friends and colleagues on the other side of the pond. But it's clear to me that there's a swing that goes back and forth in terms of centralization and decentralization of giving. And if you only look at a short period of time, it looks like there's a trajectory. I'm not sure there is. I think and this is not just in Jewish giving. If you think back into the 1950s and before that, you had a much stronger sense of centralized giving, United Way in the States. That's not a Jewish organization, but there was umbrella giving. You give it to a centralized place which has the resources, the capacity to allocate it. The Jewish community followed that. What you saw then was when tax reasons and the 60s and the sort of lack of deference to authority sort of kicked in, you saw the explosion of family foundations in the States. That didn't happen in the UK, partly for sociological reasons, but I think largely because of tax reasons. There's not the same sort of tax advantages to creating your own family foundation. But then what you saw after you had this sort of flourishing, I can't remember the exact statistics, I think 5,000 family foundations emerged within the course of 10, 15 years. It was just ridiculous. And each of them had the advantages of really being able to pursue specific goals and measure impact in the way that they wanted to and feel a personal connection to their causes. And it wasn't coordinated, and they were all starting to replicate each other. So then what do you see? You see the birth of the JFN, the Jewish Funders Network, which takes all of these family foundations and says, you know what, guys, we're going to pull you together. We're not going to have you do shared giving, but we'll run conferences, we'll create interest groups. So that's where you see this centralization, decentralization swinging back and forth. That is very, very healthy. And I think the answer is not to say, oh, this is bad or this is good, but to say, where are we on that pendulum and what kind of correctives need to be put in place in order to maintain that tension? If in the era of centralized giving, people had recognized the signs, and they did because the federations made an adamant stance of we will not allow designated giving, well, then they were too far on the side of centralization. So I would suggest that that both are necessary, and we want to always keep mechanisms in place for the advantages of centralization, which is coordination and strategic planning, and decentralization, which allows for a real connection between the giver and the cause. So that, there's all sorts of advantages to others in other ways, but I think both are essential.
So I agree with everything Shoshana said. I'm just going to add some stuff to it. First of all, I think it's definitely a pendulum. Second of all, there was a very strong argument, and there is always an argument, for federated giving and these charities that my dad kept supporting. I mean, in the earlier era before federation, that's how many there were. There was like a Jewish day school on this block in Brooklyn. There was a Jewish old age home. And it was just crazy, and only a few people sort of gave to everything. So that was the notion for federated giving. Now, that said, I believe the federations created many of their own problems, you're saying, by not allowing designated giving. But before that, they became increasingly non-transparent. They became increasingly, in my view, subject to the whims of their largest donors. So instead of just looking at the field of childcare or the field of Jewish need in New York and being as informed, research-based, and dispassionate as possible, and then carefully measuring outputs and outcomes, they listened to the people on their board who were giving them the largest sums, and the money tended to go that way. There was also, more regrettably, a tendency on the part of some givers around the United States, I don't know about Great Britain at all, around the United States and dramatically in New York, who liked giving things that had their names on the top of the buildings. And while I don't agree with every one of Maimonides' principles all the time, I would say that there are certain names, there's some New Yorkers here laughing, who you can imagine this name. It's not just Donald Trump. You know, it's all being done about Trump right now. But I'm thinking about not-for-profit institutions, hospitals, schools that have, you know, that people were interested in how large their name would be. And there's a famous, famous, famous controversy, which you can Google. I won't mention to you the names of the two families, but a fight between two of the wealthier Jewish families in New York about whether or not to have their name on the children's zoo in the New York City park. It was like ridiculous and embarrassing, at least for me as a Jew, that that's what they were fighting about. Even though one was in favor of naming and one was in favor of not naming, that shouldn't have been the issue. I want to say something about these family foundations and designated giving, and Shoshana said some of it. But folks, there's a lot of research on organizations and charitable organizations, and too many funders don't look at the research. So they're giving to organizations that have terrible ratings from the three organizations in the states that rate charities. They're giving to organizations that have some of the best purposes and intentions and would love your $5,000, but they can't conceivably tell you what happened to it because they haven't built that into any of their work. And so there is this tension back and forth. And so sometimes you may know that you love this organization that you saw while you were hiking in Nepal, but don't give to them unless you can find somebody who will really tell you what kind of work they're doing. And so now I get to sort of say as an example, so I can think of a funder who was interested in American Jewish World Service work. Some debate with me about which aspects of our work they were interested in, but then said they liked some of our funding of grassroots social change projects, and they'd like to know what work we were doing in the two countries they were most interested in. And I had to come back and say, actually, neither of those is a country in which we work, so maybe we don't have common cause. And then they said, okay, but we love the work we're doing. So even though it's a more quote-unquote federated approach, because you're amassing all the information, you're choosing the countries, you're choosing the projects, we're just going to fund you for the work we do. That foundation was Trevor Pears.
Thanks. So when you ask yourself the questions, I have limited resources or a community has limited resources, to whom should I devote those resources? Where do you seek Jewish wisdom to start addressing that question? Are there particular Jewish texts you draw upon? Are there moments in our history you draw upon? Are there Jewish figures in your lives you draw upon? Sort of where do you go for Jewish wisdom to start tackling that very difficult question, how to prioritize where I devote my limited resources?
So there's so many places I could go to. I could go to texts, I could go to history, but I'm going to go to the Jewish calendar. I'm going to go to the two holidays that we have that are week-long holidays. That would be Pesach and Sukkot. And they come exactly 6 months apart. Exactly. And I want to suggest that these two holidays embody the two values that you're suggesting. Pesach is the most particularistic holiday that we have. It is the birth of the Jewish people. It is almost entirely about the Jewish people, even though we've made it quite ecumenical and it's about freedom. No, it is about the birth of the Jewish people. And actually, halachically in temple times, non-Jews didn't participate in Pesach. And then exactly 6 months later, you've got Sukkot, which is the antithesis. It's the holiday that biblically we gave a sacrifice for every nation in the world. It's when we pray for rain. Well, we don't pray for rain for Jews. We pray for rain for the world. And when you look at the whole cycle of the Jewish holidays, you have to visit both of those themes for a week during the course of a year. If you're an observant Jew, you cannot get away from spending a week in a Sukkot mindset thinking about global issues and the entire world and all of humanity, and you have to spend an entire week thinking about the Jewish issues. What is the particular nature of Jewish identity and Jewish particularism? And I think our calendar does that to immerse us in each of those as absolutely vital. So I think my critique of the Jewish community is that there are lots of people who identify as a Pesach Jew. It's about the Jewish people, and I need to focus all my energy on the Jewish people. And they sort of forget about the humanity side of it. And there's also lots of Jews who go, I'm a citizen of the world, and this particularistic Jewish identity I don't want. And they actually celebrate Pesach in a very universalistic way, and vice versa. There's the Pesach Jews who celebrate Sukkot in a very particular way. And I want to suggest that, again, there's this dialectic between the two that needs to be exhibited in our giving, and that our giving needs to be very much, yes, what am I going to do to help the Jewish people and to focus on very particular Jewish needs? And what am I going to do as that citizen of the world to focus on helping all human beings? And that's where I really go to. And I'm always thinking of which one am I leaning too much towards at this moment in my life and I need to have the corrective for. And that influences the way I celebrate that particular chag. And I'll give a little bit more energy to the chag that actually is my weaker arm.
So I'm happy to say here's an area where we disagree, although we end up with absolutely the same commitment to balance. So first of all, you asked for text, so I want to just do a shout out for the Chevruta study here this week, which is about tzedakah, which is a phenomenal compendium of all of the text, both ancient and contemporary, about tzedakah. How much should you give? Is it clear when the Babylonian Talmud says, prefer your own people over the people in the next town, prefer the poor over the rich? Does that really make it clear? And the answer is it doesn't. But the texts are really valuable, and they contain all of the arguments both ways for universal and particular and why. So there's a huge volume of text to look at. You asked about text influencing us, so I'm going to make sure I take this opportunity. My single most important text to me is a modern text from Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said, in a free society where terrible wrongs exist, some are guilty, all are responsible. And I've used that to define always giving outside of the things that I caused, you know, but the things for which I should feel responsible as a Jew, as an American, and as a global citizen. Now, where we do on the particular universal, where we agree is I think every person, and I'm actually teaching this on Thursday morning in case you want to come, ought to think of themselves as having circles of obligation, the closest in to the furthest out. And I'm not arguing for choosing one over the other. I'm arguing of being aware of your obligation in and to different circles. So the place where we disagree, I just love this, is that at American Jewish World Service, we shamelessly use Pesach as an opportunity to think about freedom for other people. So I agree with Shoshana's definition of the holiday, but anybody who's ever used our Seder table materials or gone on our website, it's who is most oppressed this time. And when I was in New York City government and there were early on a couple of unfair arrests and police mistreatment of people of color in New York City, we made that an element on the Seder plate. So we've always used Seders, even before I got to American Jewish World Service, for like, let's think about all of the other people in the world who are not sufficiently free, and let's make this a universal holiday about the fight for freedom. But on the rest of the issues, we agree.
We'll see if we can find other moments where you disagree.
I'll also just put in, because there's so much need in the world, and there's no way I can fulfill all of the need that there is. And there are times when that overwhelms me. It really does. And particularly, I find, I don't know whether it's the older I get or whether technology is doing this. I can't quite tell whether it's a stage in my life or just that more and more information comes at me. And so I'm far more aware of the magnitude of the need that is out there. And there are times where I want to go hide because I can't figure out how I am going to meet this need. And so sometimes it really helps me to look to my children who are still quite young, but old enough. They're in primary school. My oldest just started secondary school. And some of you in the UK know that when you go into Waitrose, they give you these little green coins. So when you check out at the checkout counter, they give you a little green coin. And then they have three boxes, transparent boxes, and three different charities that they're supporting that week. And you can put your little green coin in there. And then dependent on the percentage that's in each box, Waitrose does their corporate social responsibility to those charities. And I have learned so much from watching my children do this. So now when I go through the checkout line, I know enough to not just get one little green coin. We get three. But they go, and while I'm checking out and doing everything, they go over to the three boxes, and they read about the dog shelter, and they read about the hospice, and they read about the refugee center. And then there's a debate that starts between the three of them. And I have to tell you that, I mean, it is far more sophisticated than most debates that I hear anywhere else because they've got it right. Well, you know, one of them will say, well, I'm going to give it to this one because, look, there's lots and lots of coins in there, so it must be a good charity, okay? In other words, if lots of other people have done, then there's due diligence and it must be a good charity. And the other one goes, no, that one has enough. This one doesn't have very much. This is the one that needs it. I'm going to give it there. And then, you know, the philosopher amongst them goes, yes, but this one is doing, you know, is going to teach the people to fish and not just give them the fish. And I listen to my children debate this and I think to myself, you know what? I can go and do all of my metrics as I should. Absolutely. You go and you can check and there's lots of resources to make sure that money is being well spent. But when it comes down to it, you have to figure out which of those ways of deciding resonate for you. Because it's that personal investment when they finally put it in and they get the satisfaction of knowing that I have given and I have helped and they feel a connection to it that I think closes that loop that makes you feel like, yes, okay, I haven't done everything and I haven't solved all the problems of the world, but I just did something. And once you start that cycle, then you're going to do it again.
So three quick comments on that. First of all, I think that the status of the media and of social media is, I mean, that's why we know so much more about what's happening in so many parts of the world. And so the positive questions, particularly from a Jewish point of view, is, so who are today's other and today's stranger? And how do we find out? On the issue of being overwhelmed, I would just leave you with one of my thoughts, which is, of course, we all feel that way some of the time. But given who we are, and I include everyone in this room, we really can't retreat to the convenience of being overwhelmed because there's always something to do. And we come from a faith that says, if you save one life, you save the world. I love the story about Waitrose. Maybe we should have that in the States. We don't. But there is something that all of you can do, which we started doing 10 years ago. And that is when our grandchildren turn 9, we tell them that there's a $100 account for them with their parents to give to charity, and as long as they tell us at the end of the year what they've given it to, they will get more the next year. And they make wise choices, like Shoshana said, but they also make choices that totally stun their parents and occasionally their grandmother. I mean, and things you would not have imagined them to know about, literally to know about. So when my grandson, who turns 18 next week, was being bar mitzvah, he decided, no, it wasn't actually, it would have been better if he decided, his parents told him he had to give to an American Jewish World Service program. And I criticized them for that. And then I asked him what he was interested in, and he said, I'm interested in hungry children. And we went on the AJWS website, and I was telling him projects I'd visited and what they were doing. And his sister was there. She was 8. And he told her to leave the room. And you can imagine what the fight that ensued. And I said to her, look, this is Jonah's business. So she left the room. And he said to me, Grandma, I want to give to child soldier programs, but I didn't think Lila should know about that. And I mean, I was stunned. And I said, well, we support child soldier programs, but where do you know about them? And he said, I saw it on the History Channel. So I came out and said to his parents, you know, you're being careful what you wished for. Your son is going to stand up in shul and talk about child soldiers. But these kids know what's going on. And so giving them a chance to think about giving and how to make a difference is well worth it, because otherwise they think that these are things we're not talking about.
Something that I'm picking up in what you're both saying is sort of one of the underlying principles of Jewish giving might be the conversation that happens around it. That almost engaging in the conversation is maybe the most important ingredient to how we choose where to give. And that maybe our tradition is not so specific on instructing us what or whom to give to, but does encourage critical debate, and that should be sort of invested in our conversations about giving as much as it's invested in every other place within our Jewish lives.
Absolutely. And I love the way my children, when we have these conversations, they're not stuck in some of the categories that we are. So it's very, very fluid for them. So you're going to think all of my conversations with my children happen in the supermarket. I was shopping with them, and I was walking over towards the bananas, and my son ran out in front of me and body blocked the bananas. He's going, "No, you can't go there," right? I was like, "What's going on?" He said, "Wait." He says, "I have to check them." And I'm thinking, why is my son checking the bananas? Fair trade, right? So he had learned about fair trade at school. Now, this gets even more complex. How did he learn about fair trade at school? Because TZEDEK, which is the British equivalent of AJWS, right? So TZEDEK, which deals with global poverty issues, had done a program in their school where they had twinned with a school in Ghana. So they'd been writing letters back and forth to Ghana. And as part of that, they had learned some basic economics and basic ideas about trade. And they'd learned what free trade was. And what my son had taken away from that is, if you buy something that is not fair trade, you are hurting my friend in Ghana, who I've been writing letters to. So he was checking the bananas, right, in order to make sure that we weren't going to hurt his kid. Now, was this Jewish? You know, was this about global issues? Like, for him, there were no, this was all one. This was a Jewish school he was going to, where he had a pen pal in Ghana. He had learned about fair trade, but it was all very, very fluid and very natural and happening in the supermarket. So I guess the lesson is, if you want to really teach your kids about tzedakah, you go to Waitrose.
This is Global Torah Live. You're listening to our conversation with Shoshana Boyd-Gelfand and Ruth Messenger at Limud UK.
So what I'm hearing from both of you is actually you're painting a almost idealistic picture of a global Jewish community that's really actively engaged in global giving, and that this is our highest Jewish value, or one of our highest Jewish values, and we all agree on this side of the room. I'm wondering, when you've each encountered voices that came up against the global aspect of the work that both Paris Foundation and AJWS do, where were those voices coming from? Was there value in what they were saying, that global challenges should not be our highest priority or should not be our community's highest priority all the time? Ruth, do you want to start?
Well, since I talk about this and did it for a living for a long time, yes, there's always someone saying that. So first of all, I want to sort of put them into categories. So some of them are people who raise local issues simply to distract. So sometimes they say, "I'm only working in the Jewish community here." But sometimes they say, like, "Why are you working in Uganda? There are problems in East LA." And I have found, not to be terribly mean, but that if you say to those people in an audience, "That's great. It's good. That's what you're doing. What are you doing in East LA? They're never doing anything." No, I mean, really, the people who are doing the work would talk about it differently. The people who are there, so there are a lot of people who are simply throwing, what's that expression, throwing something into the crankcase or something so it doesn't go round. But they're not people who are serious about their own giving of either time or money. Then there are people who ask very seriously about, like, "Wait a minute, there's need at home. There's need in the Jewish community. There's need in Israel. So why are you doing that?" And so for me, the answer is very complicated. The first answer is, like, look, indeed, if you're serious about your giving and you've decided to prioritize some of your own circles of obligation, and those are small and close to you, you know, more power to you. That's Jewish, to be thoughtful and strategic and to give and to tithe yourself, whatever tithing means to you, and do it regularly, you know, kol hakavod. But if you want to think more broadly, or think as a synagogue community or a Hillel, then you need to look at need all over the world. And then you need to look at our text, which you asked about before, which do say, support both the Jew and the non-Jew, and there's debate about which non-Jews and for what reasons, but it's very, very thoughtful rabbinic commentary from several thousand years ago, and it can be brought up to time today. And then there's another very powerful argument, which I want to say sometimes I get, so I'll tell you one more story. During the Darfur crisis, when we were leaders and standing against the genocide, pushing to change U.S. policy, but also raising money, I was at a congregation in Los Angeles, and I spoke, and then there was a question and answer session afterwards in a side room, and I could tell this man was going to explode with concern about what I was talking about. So I called on him first, and he just let loose. How can you be helping black people in Africa? You know, I don't care what's happening in Darfur. That's not of interest to the Jewish community. And as he was, like, exploding with his question, I noticed this woman. I've often described her as a little old lady in tennis shoes, and her daughter told me afterwards that she doesn't like being described that way, but she was a little old lady in tennis shoes anyway. And I see her, like, walking across the room toward that guy, so I have no idea what's going on. And she gets literally, I'm not exaggerating, nose to nose with this man as he finishes his question, and she said, "It's because of people like you that I don't have any relatives." So, you know, I said I have nothing to say. So, you know, that's a piece of the story, is that people have been there for Jews at their time of oppression, and we can always say, clearly, not enough. And Jews can be there for other people at the time of their oppression and need, and that's really, for me, what the Torah is all about.
I would just go back to what I said about Pesach Jews and Sukkot Jews. It's both, and I absolutely support what some might view as parochial Jewish issues. We need to have Jewish education. We need to have synagogues. We need to have Jewish communal structures. And that costs money. And absolutely, our tzedakah needs to go for that. And it needs to go for Sukkot types of causes as well. So I think the push that you're talking about are, for me, the people who sometimes say, "I only think Jews should be giving to Jews." It's interesting, Trevor Pears, who I work for, is very fond of saying when somebody asks, "So what percentage of the foundation's funding goes to Jewish causes?" And he always says, "Every penny." And then people say, "But wait a minute, don't you run the autism center at da-da-da, and don't you do this around preventable blindness?" And he goes, "Yep." And either you get it or you don't. That for him, those are Jewish causes, just as much as Jewish education is, because he understands that when you go to Waitrose and you see the banana and you've learned about that in a Jewish school and you understand that you're connected to this and that that's connected to Jewish texts and values, that it is all interconnected. And in fact, he really likes to shake it up in very, I think, interesting and clever ways. One of his insights, and I remember him throwing this one at me when I first started there. The foundation runs a program at Hebrew University, Paris Fellows Program in the School of Agriculture and the School of Public Health, which brings over government officials from the developing world to study for a year in Israel, get their master's degree in public health or in agriculture, both of which Israel has particular expertise in terms of techniques that are applicable to the third world. And then those people go back to India or to Ghana or to Ethiopia. And I love that one, because what is that? Right? The check is going to Hebrew University. So some people would say that's a Jewish cause. It's going to fund non-Jews to learn from Israeli expertise and the beneficiary. Who is the beneficiary of that bit of tzedakah? And for me, that just embodies how interconnected the world is that we live in, where these categories of Jewish and global, actually, they've imploded in really wonderful ways. And not that many people give me enough time to answer in that way, but that is my answer to it, that yes, we need to also do Jewish education, Jewish institutions, but those categories are imploding in, I think, quite radical and extraordinary ways.
And the extent to which you make this more universal, exactly along the lines that Shoshana was speaking about, again, define a role for Jews in the world as a people committed to social justice. So that government official in Ghana knows that he got his training or she got her training in Israel. And I promise you that that's of significance and value. I was once in Senegal with an agricultural project that we were supporting. And when I arrived, the man said, "There's some farmers who want to talk to you." And I said, "Okay." And they came and they asked me again, "You're American Jewish World Service, right? Can we come to us with us on our truck? We want to show you something." And we drove 4 kilometers and the country was in the middle of a drought, and we drove to a really scraggly orchard, but I could tell it was a planted orchard because trees were in a row. And they said, "This is the Israeli forest. Could you get them back to help us, please?" So, you know, that's the impact we make in the world, that you actually have no idea. They had some vague connection between Israel and Jewish, and there I was on the ground, and they needed help with their forest, and sadly they didn't know how to contact Moshav, so they contacted me, but which was several steps away from what they needed. But nevertheless, I mean, I think it's, and that's why, you know, Trevor just is correct and couldn't be clearer. This is all practicing Judaism, but it's in, the reason we use the term global citizen is because that's the nature of the globe we're in, and people are always sort of learning from each other and about each other and helping each other and remembering to give back. And I can't begin to tell you how many stories like that that we have from the work that we've done. One more, at the time of the Darfur crisis, there was a rally in Washington, huge. Some Americans here may have been there. And there was a contingent of Darfuri refugees who were living in Portland, Maine. I would not have had a clue they were living in Portland, Maine, but they heard about the rally and they came. And so we went to greet them. And they did an impromptu press conference. And the reporter from the Washington Post said, "So tell me your story." And they explained when they left Darfur and how they ended up in Portland, Maine, and why they were at the rally. And they said, "We're at the rally because our Jewish community in Portland invited us to come." And then they looked at the reporter and they said to her, I can't make this up, folks, "Did you know that the Jews had a Holocaust too?"
And I'm going to tell you one more story. I was in Ghana last year meeting with some of the alumni of this Hebrew University program, and we sort of took them to lunch, and some of them had graduated several years ago. And I said to them, "Look, I hear that you learned a lot there in terms of your technical expertise in agriculture, and that's great, that's what we wanted, and we're glad you got that. But I'm just wondering, did you learn anything else while you were there? Like, what else did you take away that has other insights?" I was just curious about what happens when you go and you study someplace like Israel for a year, particularly when you're not Jewish. Like, what do you make of all of this? So one of them said, he's actually in a very high position now in terms of the National Health Service of Ghana. And he said, "I learned to challenge authority," which was really fascinating. And the way he learned it was, I said, "Well, tell me about that." And he said, "Well, I would come to class," he said, "and people didn't just sit in class and take notes. They challenged their teachers." And he said, "And in a nice, good way, that was how learning happened." And then he gave us an example of how he had challenged. That's not how education works in Ghana. It's a very, very traditional system where, you know, teacher teaches, students listen. And he said, "And I've now started doing that when I do my budget for the year." He said, "I tell them I'll get it under the bottom line, but I want authority to switch over my budget." And he gave us an example of, he said, "We had a truck that kept breaking down, and every time we sent it out with vaccines to inoculate people, it would break down and then the vaccines would go bad." He said, "So I bought fewer vaccines and got the truck fixed. And I had to challenge authority in order to do that. But now we have more healthy people." And he said, "I never would have done that had I not studied in Israel." And I thought, this is extraordinary. Sort of some of the other thing they told us, though, was that the thing that they learned in Israel was how things run so much on time in Israel, you know?
Blurring the boundaries a bit of what's Jewish and what's not in the global sphere. There's a lot of conversations in the world of international development, particularly when it comes to philanthropy, about donor-driven versus community-driven projects. So community-driven meaning came from active listening to a community who tells us what they need versus, and you referenced this a little bit, Ruth, before, a donor being very, very interested in something that excites them, and therefore we fund what speaks to us rather than what really comes from the needs of the community. So I'm wondering if that's a conversation that's happening within the Jewish philanthropic world, and if our tradition or experience has something to teach us about that conversation.
It's not happening enough. I work for a very unusual foundation, and our foundation works, actually, we don't do a lot of work in the developing world. I say most of what we do is not, but I would say Paris Foundation is very much a foundation that partners with grantees in everything that we do. So we cannot imagine doing any sort of work without partnering with the organization that we're working with. Often we will start out by doing a piece of research together. So we'll help the organization commission a piece of research, and what emerges out of that research, then together with them, we'll think about what are some of the interventions that would be most effective for the goals that they're trying to reach. I mean, to me, that's the obvious way to do philanthropy, but it's very, very rare in terms of how one does it. And it's very difficult to prove that that has more impact than someone who has a more authoritative style of philanthropy and says, I know what's good, and here's what we're going to do, and it worked here, so of course it's going to work over here. It's hard to prove to somebody like that that it may be less predictable, and it may be a bit slower, and it may be not a straight line if you do the work in partnership. But in the long run, you will get to the right place. And the proverb that if you want to go quickly, go alone. And if you want to go far, you go together. I didn't get that right, Ruth.
If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yeah, exactly. And that notion of philanthropy, I think, should be written in large letters on the walls of every foundation. But we're nowhere close to that in terms of the larger discourse within the philanthropic sector, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I would just underscore that with like 12 red lines. And part of the proof, now I can talk for both sides of the aisle, we in America are very, very admiring of DFID, which is more sensitive to actual need in the places that they want to go in and fund than is USAID often. But nevertheless, those are government agencies going in with government geopolitical agendas, which they should have. I'm perfectly happy to have my government choosing which countries it wants to help based on its geopolitical rewards. But I'm not very happy when my country decides to spend $50 million, which is just a number I made up, but it's entirely appropriate, on literacy in East Africa without asking the people if that's what they want next or without asking the people if that's how to do it. Because even if that's what they want, we tend to bring solutions, as Shoshana said, from other places or from our own countries. We have so little sensitivity to cultural difference and to the notion. So for me, these are Jewish values. So Shema means to listen. And we don't do nearly enough listening in international development. And we ascribe very highly to the notion that everyone is equally made in the image of the Creator. And if you actually believe that the people on the solutions to the problems of the developing world are in London, Geneva, or New York, or Washington, much more would be solved than has been solved. And when you ask local people, what's your vision of justice? What is it you want to work on? How can we help you take those next steps? You get the kinds of results that each of us are talking about. And by the way, they are measurable. They're not measurable by this like grand grid coming down. You have to be very thoughtful about what outcomes are we going to look at? What are we going to, we're developing a whole strategy at American Jewish World Service for measuring changes in human rights, which is much harder than measuring changes in public health. But I mean, as an example, we're the beneficiaries of some significant grant to look at the problem of forced early marriage in India. Now, there are organizations, and they're not doing bad work. I want to be clear about that. But what they're doing is cash transfer programs that reward fathers, because they're the players here, for keeping their daughters not married for an additional year or two or three. So just think about that. It works. In that area where those cash transfers are given out, those fathers get money from the foundation or the government, and the age of marriage gradually goes up. But from our point of view, that's not the issue. First of all, that's a totally unscalable approach. There are 500 million young women in India, so can't afford that. But that's not the point. The point is, we're interested in the agency of those young girls. What do they get to say about their own lives? What do they get to say about whether or not they get to stay in school? What do they get to say and do about developing a trade? And there are organizations on the ground. We are not going in and telling them what to do. There are large numbers of organizations in the states in India where we've chosen to work that say, we think a good approach would be starting at 12 to teach boys and girls about the human rights and what's equal. We think a good approach would be to train parents about the health benefits for the young woman and her children of her marrying later and having children later. We think it would be really important to educate the community as to what will happen if all these women develop trades and become employable. And gradually that changes people's perception, and it's the best possible use of the money because it's going to really empower people, increase their own agency over their own lives, expand their most fundamental human rights, and it works. And it starts making change. And I can give you example after example where, no, we haven't solved the problem of land tenure in Oaxaca, but we have funded groups that have a clear vision of what to do in order to protect their rights to their land. And we've done that better than some larger grants by governments and foundations that assume that they have all the answers.
We have just a couple more minutes. I'm wondering if there are any questions from the audience that we can take.
I hear both your arguments about giving both to Jewish causes and non-Jewish causes as global citizens of the world and good Jews. But I am always torn because if Jews don't give to Jews, nobody else will, and everyone will give to hospitals and diseases. So, Patty, we have this discussion all the time. So, first of all, I want to go back to my Holocaust story. Jews exist in this world partly because people came to save our lives. And we cannot forget that. This woman knows more about Holocaust rescuing and rescuers than anybody in the world. And some of those people were not Jewish people, and they stuck their necks out. And not only is it therefore a text-based concern of ours, but it's a moral responsibility. It's the opposite of pay it forward or pay it backward or whatever. I don't understand how that works. But the notion is we were saved by people. We have an obligation. I also want to comment on the examples you gave. So I don't want to attack anyone's charity, but there are some things that are comparatively well-funded. Hospitals and diseases are comparatively well-funded because, thank God, even those people who aren't really powerful charitable givers, if they came through a bout of kidney disease, will give to the Kidney Foundation. That's the way it should be. And so look for the things that people aren't supporting. Look for the farmers in Central America who just want title to their land. Last observation, there's a woman in the States, some of you may know her, named Eva Fogelman, who's a psychologist, sociologist, who wrote a brilliant book, this is in response to Patty, sort of, called Crisis of Conscience or something like that. It's an interview with Holocaust rescuers in which they were asked why they did what they did, and they all said, almost all of them, what else would anybody do? And she kept saying to them, no, your neighbors didn't do what you were doing. You were risking death and hiding people under the floorboards of your barn. Most people weren't doing that. And it was very hard to get them to sort of say, you know, why they were the unusual ones. And when Eva gives book tours, she says at the end of her book tour, when I finish speaking, several of you will come up and say, because she tells these powerful stories, some of you will come up and say, I can't imagine what I would have done. And she says, the only question is, what are you doing?
And that's our episode. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more live recorded episodes featuring Dr. Aviva Gottlieb-Zornberg, Diana Ginsberg, Rabbi Yedidia Sinclair, and more. Global Torah was created in partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks to the Olam and Pardes teams, to Ben Wallach and Seth Samuel, to our friends at Limud UK, and to our guests Ruth Messenger and Shoshana Boyd-Gelfand. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. You can learn more and hear our first full season at pardes.org.il and at olamtogether.org.